prevailed. I don't know what the numbers were. My understanding was they weren't terribly close.
Your minister was on which side?
Oh, he certainly would have been on Hawke's side. I mean, I think the whole ministry supported Hawke. And Keating came out of that meeting, and I remember him, this is maybe paraphrasing what he said, but he said, I think, I have fired the only shot I had in my locker. In my view, over the ensuing next months, this is a personal view, I believe two very senior journalists decided that it wasn't the only shot that he had in his locker. And in my view, Michelle Grattan and Laurie Oakes ran an unpaid but very strong campaign to get Keating elected Prime Minister.
How did this debate was obviously an ongoing one.
It
How
was.
Did it affect your work for Minister in those years? That would have been from Michael Tate still.
Yes. I don't think it affected us at all in terms of our work, but clearly there was an atmosphere within the ministry and within the parliament. I think, and again, my belief was this was fueled by the Age and News Limited. So Oakes and Grattan, or Grattan and Oakes in that order, they decided that Keating was the right man for the job and they were going to promote him as strongly as they could in everything they did. Mm. And I think that was picked up by the broader media as well. And I think there was a groundswell that grew and grew and grew until the second challenge in December and Hawke.
Did this change in atmosphere that you mentioned, did that sort of get steadily more noticeable from your work point of view? Or was it really, were you in a sense in a cocoon, isolated from those conflicts?
Well, as I said, just a little bit earlier, I don't think it affected our work, but it clearly affected the politics. So in terms of the policy, we just got on and did the job that we were doing. We had, of course, some interesting treasurers in that time, John Kerrin and so on. Ralph Willis, I think, and John Kerrin were two of the treasurers who were in that six-month period. But I think it was much more of an issue for the politicians themselves.
So did you have any discussions within your office at all, either involving the minister or amongst yourselves?
I think we probably did, but it wasn't top of mind by any means. I think the people involved in caucus and in factions and that sort of thing, clearly it was an issue for them. But that was in our office, very much separate from what we were doing as providing the policy direction.
So when Keating finally was appointed by caucus and became Prime Minister, did you suspect that your then minister would not be appointed in the new ministry?
I don't know that I had thought ahead, because of course the election was a fair while away. But I think the change prompted me to leave. And so I did. I left towards the end of 92. Mm. And I think it was just before Keating became Prime Minister. But I was back again straight after the next election. So, but I don't know that... I suppose I had a view of Keating, which was that he was no Bob Hawke. And I had a lot of respect for Hawke and for what the Hawke government had done. And of course, Keating was a pretty key part of that, but I certainly didn't regard him as being a Bob Hawke by any stretch of the imagination. So, I mean, it wasn't something that the change to Keating didn't affect me in any real sense, but it wasn't something I wanted to continue. And again, I had, you know, still a young family, and I wanted to do something else.
Yeah. Talking about something quite a bit different, going back a few years, not to June 1988. A story about the final, I suppose we'd call, night of sittings and the big party.
Well, it would have been May. think, the last night of sittings down there, because we actually moved up here on the same day as the opening of the Parliament in 1928, so that was in May. But anyway, it was an interesting night. There were parties everywhere, both sides of politics. There was certainly more than one or two beers drunk that night and one or two bottles of wine. I only remember one incident that sticks in my mind. I observed it. I didn't participate in it. I know that there is photographic evidence of it, but I don't have a photograph. There was a large portrait of Sir John Kerr, obviously as a former Attorney General. And I observed three colleagues who were Labor staffers turned their back to the photograph or to the painting of Sir John Kerr and to drop their trousers. I think it's called mooning. And as I said, I not only observed it, but I know there is photographic evidence, but I can't give away anything more.
Details will be kept confidential.
Well, I think for life, I hope. But it was just something. Look, it was triggered by the drink more than anything else, and it was a laugh rather than anything else. I don't know that anybody who might have been of a different political persuasion would have laughed, but it was certainly something that boys will be boys.
Before we talk on about some individual parliamentarians that you've mentioned, I wondered, did you have any contact with an earlier Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, or John Howard, who later became Prime Minister? Did you have any dealings with either of them during your time?
I can't think of any occasion where I had any connection with Malcolm Fraser. And I think the same applies with John Howard, interestingly. And probably for most of the time, I was on the Senate side. And Fraser had already gone, of course, by the time I came to work in Michael Tate's office in 1987. And Howard was in and out of the ministry and in and out of the leadership and all of those sorts of things. So I didn't have any real contact with Howard until 1996.
Yeah, not sure after this period, yeah. Mm. You mentioned, had a fairly substantial list of individuals that stand out in your memories of the times. And the first one, about whom there is also a special story, I believe, Gareth Evans. And you said they mentioned there was a special story involving a junior minister when Evans was Transport Minister.
Yes,
around 1988.
Evans was Transport Minister. We were still in the old Parliament House. He had his office on, and he was leader of the he was deputy leader of the government. John Button was the leader of the government, so they were both in the same southern corridor of the Senate side. Michael Tate, as the Minister for Justice, had a responsibility for joint responsibility with customs. The Australian Federal Police and Customs ran a thing called Coast Watch, which was done with aeroplanes and that sort of thing. We still have a thing that does it, but I can't remember the precise incident, but it was something to do with allegations on a television program about being able to fly a light aircraft into Australia across the West Coast and avoid Coast Watch. And the guy who did this story, it might have been 7:30 or whatever the forerunner, this day tonight, no, whatever the forerunner of 7:30 report. I might be wrong, but this guy was in the aeroplane, and they filmed this incursion across the west coast of Australia where Coast Watch missed them and all that sort of thing. And he said, this is the way all drugs are getting into Australia and so on. So we were a bit concerned about that, and Gareth Evans was, and the junior minister who had actual responsibility for coast for that flying side of things was Peter Duncan. And Evans called a meeting in his office in the evening, and he asked for Michael Tait to come and for Peter Duncan to come, and Gareth was there. So we gathered in his office. There was Michael and I arrived, and Gareth and Joe Thwaites, who was his private secretary, chief of staff, and myself turned up, and we're waiting there for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes or so. And Peter Duncan came through the door and just sauntered in and, "G'day," sorry, didn't even say, "Sorry, I'm late." And he was just sort of a brash young man, I think, as I described him earlier. And Gareth's response to this sauntering in was peppered with very colourful language, which told Peter to be very quiet, not say another word, and sit down. But there were a lot of adjectives in the... I couldn't use the same words in the same measure as Gareth could, but it was certainly a put down of a junior minister such as I had never witnessed before and have never witnessed since. So it was just one of those little... Another of Gareth's stories that you know, the Parliament resounds with if you talk to people who knew him. I don't even remember the outcome of the meeting, but I just remember that, you know, being late for a meeting with Gareth and then not apologising, I think, was pretty close to a mortal sin.
What was your view of Gareth Evans as a politician, as a minister?
I think he's, again, one of the brilliant ministers, fantastic debater in the Parliament, a very strong policy. And I think the fact that he still now is leading debate around a whole range of international issues is a measure of the man. I think he was... This is a little story. Duncan Kerr, Michael Tait and Gareth Evans. Duncan Kerr was once heard to say that the three best lawyers in the whole Parliament, for both intelligence and knowledge of the law, were Gareth Evans, Michael Tait, and Duncan Kerr. And I must say that I would put Gareth in front of both of the others. An intellect of enormous capacity, able to get to the nub of issues so quickly and succinctly, but, you know, with great clarity.
And a great temperament as well.
Well, he had a temperament that, yes, I think volcanic is one word I've heard used, and I probably used it myself. He used to be very short in terms of the capacity of technology to support what he was doing. He was prone to dictating speeches or papers on one of those little handheld dictaphones, I think they were called, and then he'd give it to his personal assistant who used to do all his typing, and she would sit there with the button on the floor and going. And at one stage, on one of these tapes, and she turned it on and started it, there was nothing on it. And she tried it many times, and then she went and saw Joe Thwaites and said, "Joe, look, I don't know how to do this." So Joe, of course, being the chief of staff, had to go into Gareth and say, "That tape you just gave us to type up had nothing on it." And Gareth grabbed it out of Joe's hands and threw it against the wall and smashed it into smithereens. It turns out he'd pressed the wrong button. But I suspect the speech that he then dictated was probably better than the one he threw.
You mentioned another familiar name, Graham Richardson. Was that someone you had personal dealings with?
Yes. Mainly from a point of view of location again. We were in that same corridor, the back corridor in the Senate, and he was in the corner. And Gerry Hand was in between us, I think, as the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. So I got to know Graham and his staff because we were just there. I certainly don't think we had any great dealings with Graham's office, but I mean, he's, as he still is, a larger than life person, and he was very much the New South Wales right leader, and all of those sorts of things, and they had good parties.
Lionel Bowen, what about him?
Well, Lionel, of course, was the Attorney General when we became, when Michael became the Minister for Justice, and so we saw him every day that the Parliament sat, because we went there for briefings around question time. There was also a guy in his office by the name of Bill Botell, who very much drove the whole, he and Neil Blewett as the Minister for Health. Bill was in Lionel's office, I think, representing or doing a lot of the work around human rights and that sort of thing. And so the whole issue of AIDS was very much on the agenda in those days, the AIDS epidemic. And Bill Botell and Neil Blewett, I think, drove very much the campaign that, you know, the Father Time with the sickle and all that sort of thing that was, and the bowling balls knocking people over. So, and Lionel was one of the most gentle men I think I've ever met for a politician. But he had a veneer of gentleness, if I can put it that way. But he was a fantastic politician. He was glue, I think, in terms of the first and second Hawke ministries. He was the glue that held them all together. He was never going to become Prime Minister, but he was the shoo-in for the Deputy Prime Minister's job because of his personal capacity, but also, I think, the great respect that all of his colleagues had for him.
What about Peter Walsh? It's another name you mentioned.
Yes, well, only because of his great capacity to be the character of the Senate, but also very important in terms of the whole, you know, they talk about the Hawke Keating ministry and their pretty good management of the economy. People don't mention Peter Walsh very much at all, but as the Minister for Finance, he was the man who found all the savings and, you know, did all of the sort of work around making sure that the Hawke Keating budgets worked. And but he certainly was eccentric. He liked a glass of red wine. I certainly personally observed his mid-evening peregrinations up the stairs to the press gallery, which were above the Senate side of the House, with a silver bag under his arm, which was the internal part of a cask of red wine. He carried it around with a glass, and he would chat with journalists all through the press gallery about all sorts of things. And I think the last time we spoke, we were talking about the night that we debated, or the Senate debated, the four referendum bills, and having to get outright majorities. Peter was certainly more than four sheets to the wind, with shoeless. He did have his socks on. Each time I had to get all of the people down the corridor into the chamber for the Senate votes, or for the votes against each part of the referenda that the opposition called divisions on. And on one occasion, he bounced himself off the walls of the corridor as we walked to the chamber singing the Internationale.
So you actually had a side task or role of being almost like a whip.
Well, he was me.
Yeah.
Oh yes, I think it, that was part of the, because you were in the old house, the bells only rang for 2 minutes, and while that was enough time to get from anywhere in the old house to the chamber, when you're having a division every 5 minutes and sometimes a 10 minute break where, you know, they had another drink, it was certainly something that, and particularly on that piece, that those pieces of legislation where you had to have an absolute majority rather than just the majority, it was pretty important, and my job was to make sure we had the numbers.
Mm. What about Robert Ray? Was that someone you had the personal dealings with?
Oh yeah, Robert was a new minister, I think, in the 87 ministry. I can't remember what his ministry was. It's probably on the list, but he was just around the corner and down the corridor, and we had dealings with him. It must have been because of the ministry that he held. I'm just trying to. Senator Robert Ray, here we go. Minister for Home Affairs, and then Minister assisting the Minister for Transport and Communications in that 1988 period. So I got to know him and his staff. Jeff Farey, I think, was his Chief of Staff at the time. When we moved up to the House, we got offices opposite each other, and of course Robert moved dramatically through the outer ministry and into the cabinet, and of course he's probably, his most important role was Minister for Defence for a number of years. We both had a major common interest, and that's in Australian rules football, although he's a dyed-in-the-wool Collingwood supporter and I'm a Richmond supporter. One of his staff, his closest member of staff in terms of being, she worked, Cooler, her name was, Cooler Alexiata, she worked with Robert right from the beginning until the end of his time in the Parliament. She was a Carlton supporter. So, I mean, we talked football, and every Thursday it probably was when the bulletin came out, we had morning tea and did the bulletin quiz in Robert Ray's office. Little things like that. But we had a very close relationship in a personal sense, not in a policy or politics sense. It was the closeness of the officers and the close friendship, such that, as I've mentioned earlier, I was able to go to Robert Ray when my minister was in trouble.
John Button,
again, was the leader of the government and a fantastic character, a really nice man, always smiled, didn't have a lot to do with him in a policy sense, but because of the size of the old Parliament House, you know, you couldn't help but run into people, and he was the most unflappable politician I think I've ever met. John Button, I never saw him once raise his voice. He and Lionel Bowen had very similar characteristics. They were softly spoken but very forceful in a sense. I mean, there's a saying, I think, speak softly but carry a big stick. Both of those men spoke softly, but by dint of their positions, Deputy Prime Minister and Leader of the Government in the Senate, they didn't have to show the big stick, you just knew they had one.
Not unimportant.
Mm.
Peter Cook.
Peter Cook was, again, down the end of the corridor from us. He was also in the same faction as Michael Tate, the centre-left. Along with people like Neil Blewett and others, the centre-left was a pretty important faction for that mid No, well, sir, certainly the whole of the Hawke government up until Keating. I think the Keating emergence as Prime Minister probably was the end of the centre-left faction, because my understanding, not that I was ever part of it, but I think they were the group that splintered when it came to the second Hawke-Keating challenge. So Peter Cook was close again in proximity to us, both in the old and the new Parliament houses. We had a couple of common bits of work we did together. So I knew Gary Quinlan, whom I mentioned earlier, who's the current ambassador to the United States, to the United Nations, was Peter Cook's chief of staff. They were just, you know, you didn't feel, well, I suppose it's interesting. I think that relationships were a very important part of the way that the Hawke government worked.
You mentioned Don Chipp, an interesting character. He was, of course, not anything to do with Labour at this point in the time you joined it. What were your impressions of him?
An interesting character. I actually first met him when I wasn't in Parliament House in the direct sense. But I was running, I was still in the public service, and I was running a little program for young Australian political leaders, the Australian Council of Young Political Leaders, ACYPL, and Doug McClelland, Sir Robert Cotton, Bob McMullen, Sid Spindler. They were members of this group that was a bipartisan group, and they worked with an American group and ultimately a Chinese group, where groups of young politicians went overseas and we hosted groups from those other countries in Australia. And Don Chipp was leader of the Australian Democrats. And the first group of these young politicians from the United States that I hosted, we visited Parliament House and we got in to see the members of that group. And Don Chipp hosted us for afternoon tea in his office. And this group, there were 8 young American politicians, 4 from the Republicans and 4 from the Democrats. And one of the Republicans was a potato farmer from Idaho. And we were talking with Mr. Chipp, as he was known, in his office, and he was talking about the nuclear disarmament and we needed to, you know, rid the world of nuclear weapons and all this sort of thing. And that he very much supported the policy of the Hawke government not to allow nuclear-powered warships into Sydney Harbour and all this sort of thing. And this young man from Idaho, I remember saying, "But Mr. Chipp, if we don't have nuclear weapons, how else are we going to save the world?" And I think for the first time in his life, Don Chipp was speechless. So that was my experience of Don. He was,
The last name on your list was Noel Crichton Brown.
Noel Crichton Brown, Senator from Western Australia, bete noir of Senator Peter Walsh. Also somebody that I never took to in any sense. He was a grumpy. Certainly I wouldn't have had a beer with him, I can say that. But one incident makes that sort of... again, it was the evening of the debate on the referendum bills, and there were these limitless and unlimited number of divisions called. And on most occasions, the government was voting no because the motions to change the legislation were being put up by the opposition. So that meant we had to go to the opposite side of the chamber to vote on each division. And on, I've mentioned the sockless Senator Peter Walsh, who was also had a few drinks that night. On one occasion, in one of the divisions, he came into the chamber, and I was sitting in the advisor's box, and I observed him cross the chamber, deliberately go to where Noel Crichton Brown's seat was, sit down and put his feet, socked feet, up on the desk while the vote was being counted. And the division was over and everybody left the chamber, and I observed Noel Crichton Brown get up out of the government seats where he was sitting to vote, walked across to where his seat was, and he picked up the papers that Peter Walsh had put his socks on, and he shook them and then put them back on the desk. So it was a non-verbal incident, but one that I think highlighted that relationship that wasn't there between Noel Crichton Brown and Peter Walsh.
So in 1994, you decided to leave the job working for the minister. And what was the reason for your decision to leave?
Well, I mean, I was part of the minister's office that had called for this review. And it was one that I was clearly an advisor to the minister on. It was right at the heart of my skill set, which was around the development and the implementation of law enforcement policy. And again, it was at a time when I had decided that I didn't want to work in Parliament any longer. It had been 7 years and I just thought that it was long enough. So I applied for the job and got the job, and I spent nearly 4 years as the executive member of the Commonwealth Law Enforcement Board.
What would you say would be your fondest memories of your working life at Old Parliament House and the Australian Parliament House?
The most enjoyable part of the life? Well, clearly working for a minister in the Hawke government, I think, was a great privilege. It met my career aspirations, but also my personal beliefs and aspirations to have the opportunity to be part of a government that I think has been one of the great governments in Australian history. And it's, you know, I mean, it's a task. Chief of Staff to a Minister of State is a pretty important job, I think, and I certainly regard those 7 years as probably the most important work I've ever done. But I've had a fantastic career in all sorts of things anyway. But yeah, that's certainly a highlight.
What would be your worst memories of those years, if any?
Well, I think the two occasions on which my minister was in trouble with things, that those are always very fraught. I'm not sure that I did have... Well, I suppose, this is again a personal view, I was very disappointed when Keating beat Hawke. I think that that changed the whole dynamic of the Hawke Keating years, and I don't think that the Keating government was anywhere near as successful as the Hawke government over the years that Hawke was in charge.
Are there any last points you'd like to make at this point?
No, look, this has been an absolutely fantastic historical journey through, 15 years in a sense, because of the things, and it's a great opportunity. I mean, I hope that people listen to these stories, because they are ones that I think will make people interested in the internal workings of ministers' offices and governments.
Well, on behalf of the Museum of Australian Democracy, I'd like to thank you very much for your willingness to participate in this interview. And also, I'd like to mention that if there are things, when you have heard the tapes, that you would like to add, say more about, or things that other comments you would like to make, just get in touch with us and that can be arranged as a separate session.
Thank you very much, Edward. I really appreciate the opportunity.